Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
The Presidencies of the United States is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. If you do not receive the New York Mercantile Advertiser, the enclosed will give you the Russian account of the catastrophe of the French army. It is doubtless much exaggerated, but there is no doubt that the losses are beyond example. Whether they can be replaced so as to prevent the defection of allies and to present another formidable countenance to the North is uncertain. It does not appear that anything like despondence is felt at Paris. And so many interests on the continent have become associated with the ascendancy of Napoleon, that it will not be surprising if with the terrors of his name he should surmount his difficulties. James Madison to Thomas Jefferson, March 10th, 1813.
While reeling from their own difficulties in the first half year of war against Britain, the Madison administration was receiving reports from their diplomats in Europe and in newspaper accounts of the troubles of French Emperor Napoleon in Europe. Beyond just intellectual curiosity about foreign affairs, the president and his cabinet knew that, just as the path to war for the U.S. had been intertwined with the conflict between Britain and France, what happened in Europe in 1813 could potentially work to America's benefit or detriment in the war effort in North America. Before we get caught up with Napoleon and his Grande Armée, however, let me take the opportunity to welcome you to the Presidencies of the United States. I'm your host, Jerry Landry. Special thanks to Alex for providing the opening quote for this episode. In addition to being my better half and the person who inspired me to get into podcasting to begin with, Alex is the co-host of our new special series, The Vice Presidencies of the United States. As in the Seat at the Table series, in Vice Presidencies, we'll examine the life, career, and legacy of each of the 49 individuals who have served as the Vice President of the United States to date. At the end, we'll evaluate them and determine who truly has what it takes to preside from the Senate rostrum. A new episode of that series will be coming out soon, so be sure to check it out. In the meantime, we'll return to the narrative of the Madison Presidency series after this brief message. Gentlemen, we all know first impressions matter. And if you're not taking care of your skin, that's going to be the first thing someone notices and instantly either thinks you're older than you really are or that you just don't care about your appearance. Show them you do and make a great first impression with Caldera Lab. I know that for me, time is of the essence, and that's why I've enjoyed the experience with using Caldera Lab's products because taking just a minute or so in the morning and the evening, I've seen improvements in my skincare. You're going to brush your teeth today, so with just an extra minute in that already existing routine, you can quickly and easily take steps to leave your face refreshed. Caldera Lab creates high-performance men's skincare products, and the regimen leads off their product lineup, a twice-a-day routine to transform your skin. The regimen includes three products, the Clean Slate, the Base Layer, and the Good. The Clean Slate starts and ends your day. This face wash leaves all skin types refreshed. The Base Layer is your daily moisturizer to hydrate your skin and jumpstart your day full of confidence. The Good is your go-to multifunctional serum at night that helps your skin look tighter and smoother, as well as helps reduce the visibility of wrinkles and fine lines.
Every drop of this serum is packed with 3.4 million antioxidant units, protecting your skin. And the Caldera Lab Icon Eye Serum. It addresses the three most common skin concerns around the eye: fine lines, dark circles, and puffiness. Caldera Lab is the leader in men's skincare, made only with top-tier ingredients, and clinical trials have found 94% of men's skin showed an overall younger-looking appearance after using Caldera Lab for a few weeks. 1 minute, morning and night, is all it takes to reduce your wrinkles, fine lines, and signs of aging. And just for our audience, we have an exclusive offer. This is their best offer available anywhere. Use code PRESIDENCIES at CalderaLab.com and get 20% off right now. Again, get 20% off with code PRESIDENCIES at CalderaLab.com and make unforgettable first impressions that lead to the charming words, "You look younger." Thank you so much, and back to our program. Napoleon's private secretary wrote of the French army's entry into Moscow as follows, quote, "We hope to find rest at last, especially bountiful supplies of food and provisions." It was truly a curious and imposing sight, the sudden appearance of this vast city, more Asiatic than European in appearance. The city suddenly appearing out of a naked, deserted plain, with its 1,200 steeples, towers, clocks, and sky blue cupolas strewn with golden stars and linked by golden chains. We had paid dearly for this conquest, but Napoleon found reassurance in the hope that its seizure would result in the dictation of a solid peace. The King of Naples, who was the first to enter the city, remarked anxiously to Napoleon, however, that the city appeared uninhabited and that no military or civil delegation, no nobleman, or even a priest had come forth. French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte entered the Kremlin at noon on September 15, 1812. He noted that, quote, "Nothing had been disturbed, all the clocks still striking every quarter of an hour, chiming as if their Russian masters were still there." The emperor opted to move into the private apartments of Russian Tsar Alexander and settled in to figure out his next move. Events, however, would move out of his control as the first report of fires in the city came in at 8 p.m. that evening. Initially, there was little attention paid to this by the French military command, and the emperor himself went to bed early. By 10:30, however, it was clear that the situation was more serious than initially thought, and at 12:30, Napoleon was roused from his slumber to find that multiple fires had been deliberately set around the city. French troops managed to keep the arsonists from setting fire to the bridge south of the Kremlin, but it was a losing battle. As one of Napoleon's advisors described the situation, quote, "We were literally breathing the fire, and our lungs were inhaling pure smoke." By 4:30 p.m. on the 16th, Napoleon issued new orders. All French troops were to evacuate ASAP to Petrovsky Palace on the road to St. Petersburg. Moscow was abandoned. Napoleon had a decision to make. His intention had been to wait for the Russians to come to the negotiating table, but seeing that they were willing to destroy one of their principal cities in order to keep the resources in it from resupplying a struggling Grande Armée, forcing the Tsar and his government into a treaty seemed to be a dim prospect. The French emperor began to wonder whether it was time to cut his losses and head back west. However, reports came in from interrogations of Russian prisoners, quote, that the Russian army was in total disarray and in poor morale. Thus, Napoleon dug in his heels and stayed, convinced that he could still force his will on the Russians. He ordered his troops back to Moscow and made orders to prepare winter quarters in the captured city. Unbeknownst to him, in St. Petersburg, Tsar Alexander was fending off calls to surrender. He too stood his ground and proclaimed, quote, "It is Napoleon or I or he." He would not negotiate anytime soon. Despite the concerns of some of his advisors, the Tsar did have to his advantage that many Russian leaders and nobles were outraged, not just by the taking of a city that was seen as an ancient, sacred capital for the nation, but also because it, quote,
was accompanied by sacrilegious acts. The Grande Armée housed its horses in the churches and by violence against the civilian population. In late September, one Russian noble summed up the French Emperor's situation as follows, quote, "I believe that this success, i.e. the capture of Moscow, far from being favorable to him, has put him in difficulties of which he was previously unaware. Here, he is terribly disappointed." Meanwhile, Napoleon received reports of Allied advances against French forces in the Iberian Peninsula, and the Russian army began a counteroffensive, taking the city of Desna, which is 15 miles south of Moscow, on September 21st. Prospects for success were dwindling once more, so Napoleon decided to roll the dice and sent a letter to Tsar Alexander on the 20th asserting that, quote, "I waged war on your majesty without personal animosity. The fine, beautiful city of Moscow no longer exists because Russian Count Rostopchin had it burned. A letter of capitulation from you before or after the battle at Borodino could have stopped my march. If your majesty still holds some of his former attachments toward me, he will take this letter to heart." The Russian Tsar did not respond, and with each passing day, Napoleon isolated himself further and further from those he had led eastward into the heart of Russia. His advisors began to issue dire warnings of disaster to Napoleon if they remained in Moscow. Though the French emperor continued to protest, his biographer Alan Shome asserts that Napoleon started to make preparations to depart on October 3rd. By October 19th, Napoleon was at the head of his troops marching, quote, "through the gates of the Kremlin and Moscow for the last time, to head on a southern route back west." At this point, what had started as a military force of nearly 450,000 was down to a, quote, "effective force of 102,260. Let's pause here for a moment and turn back to Paris to catch up with the chief American diplomat there. When last we left U.S. Minister to France Joel Barlow in episode 4.22, he was making preparations to support American efforts and citizens from his posting in Paris. Barlow had received permission to issue letters of marque to American captains so that they could seize British vessels on that side of the Atlantic, and he did what he could to support the captains' efforts to find sailors for their ships. As the diplomatic officer in charge of the most prominent mission in Europe, Barlow acted as a communications hub between the U.S. and the other missions and consuls on the continent and in the Mediterranean, sharing what information came his way. However, with Emperor Napoleon invading Russia and his foreign minister, the Duke de Bassano, stationed in Vilna, Lithuania, there was not much for Barlow to do in terms of diplomatic work during the summer of 1812. This, however, changed when a ciphered letter from President Madison arrived on August 11th. As discussed in previous episodes, though the American government had imposed non-intercourse against Britain due to French assurances that they would revoke decrees that hindered American trade, the French continued to prey on American merchant ships. Madison informed Barlow that folks stateside were getting fed up with the situation and that, quote, "the full tide of indignation with which the public mind here is boiling will be directed against France, if not obviated by due reparation of her wrongs," and that, quote, "war will be called for against France by the nation almost una voce. The general exasperation will coincide with the calculation of not a few that a double war against Britain and France is the shortest road to peace." The American minister quickly sent word of Madison's letters to the French government, and a report was sent to Bassano in Vilna. However, it would take some time to arrive there and for the French foreign minister to reply. 8 days prior to the beginning of the Grande Armée's retreat from Moscow, Bassano wrote to Barlow, inviting him to Vilna to conclude an agreement on the issues between the two nations. Barlow's biographer Peter P. Hill asserts that, quote, "Barlow probably need not have gone to Vilna that fall. He had already mailed off copies of his treaty and claims convention before the invitation arrived, announcing Napoleon's readiness to sign them. And although Bassano appeared to make Napoleon's signature contingent on his appearing at the emperor's winter headquarters, Barlow might have awaited the latter's return to Paris had he been less compulsive. Barlow, however, was not willing to take anything for granted, and thus, on October 27th, he and his nephew, who was serving as the legation secretary, set out from Paris via carriage, bound east. The journey would not be an easy one, for as noted by Barlow biographer Richard Buell, quote, Vilna was 1,400 miles away. There were no good roads east of Berlin, and the further he traveled, the more likely he was to encounter severe winter weather. Though, of course, there were always doubts that the French would actually do what they said, as time and again they had pulled a fast one on American diplomats to avoid actually conceding anything, Barlow was driven to conclude a treaty with the French government and felt that a refusal of Bassano's invitation would, as he wrote to Secretary of State James Monroe, quote, give offense, or at least risk a postponement of a negotiation which I have reason to believe is now in a fair way to a speedy and advantageous close. They made their way through Frankfurt, Weimar, Leipzig, and Berlin without much of an issue. But east of Berlin, the real trouble started. Again from Buell, quote, 8 days of uninterrupted rain turned the roads of what is now Western Poland into a sea of mud. It was impossible to proceed at night or to get out of the carriage when going up or down a steep hill without muddying the sheepskin blanket on the floor that kept them warm. Growing closer to the conflict in the east, they found city gates closed to them and had to make do in the countryside. Finally, though, on November 18th, they arrived in Vilna. On their approach to the city, quote, they passed at least 600 open wagons loaded with wounded and sick men traveling westward. Some of the wagons lacked hay for their occupants to lie on because it was being fed to the horses, who died as fast as the exposed men did. Communications between Napoleon and the French officials in Vilna had been cut off by the Russians, but Barlow made note of the rumors that he was hearing of the disastrous state of the retreating Grande Armée. On the evening of October 18th, on the eve of Napoleon's retreat from Moscow, Russian forces launched a strike against 25,000 troops led by Marshal Joachim Murat, inflicting heavy losses. 5 days out since the retreat began, the Russians engaged the Emperor's forces at the small town of Maloyaroslavets in a major battle that saw control of the town go back and forth 8 times and Napoleon nearly captured by the enemy. Though the Russians suffered heavier losses, with 6,000 casualties from this one battle alone, including 7 generals, and with no reinforcements to be had, the Grande Armée crumbled. The Russians continued to harass the forces of the French Emperor in their retreat, and some of Napoleon's most trusted military commanders suffered near misses in facing complete disaster. Meanwhile, the snow began to fall, and news of French military defeats in Spain continued to come in. Again from Schoen, quote, Napoleon finally reached Smolensk on November 9th, even his imperial guard refusing to obey orders, going amok, killing, destroying, raping, and looting warehouses and homes as the temperature continued to drop. The retreat continued on, and though the Russian army surrounded them as they attempted to cross the Berezina River in late November, what remained of the French Emperor's Grande Armée managed to retreat across the river after 3 difficult days. By the end of the month, Napoleon's force was down to around 40,000 men. On December 5th, word of the desperate crossing of the Berezina and the fact that the Grande Armée was in full retreat arrived in Vilna, and, as described by Buell, quote, a mass exodus ensued. Roads clogged with carts carrying sick and wounded soldiers hindered the flight of the diplomatic corps, and the area between Vilna and Kovno turned into a charnel house, with dead horses and men strewn about the countryside. Some perished from starvation and cold. Others were cut down by flying columns of Cossacks. Barlow fared better than many because he had a French carriage that was lighter and better constructed than most. After 8 days, Barlow and his legation secretary arrived in Warsaw, then traveled on to the Niemen River, where Napoleon and his force managed to pass them on the night of December 8th. By this point, it was clear that the 1,400-mile journey to Vilna had been pointless, and Barlow wrote a poem entitled Advice to the Raven of Russia about the, quote, human carnage, that delicious fare that lured you hither, following still your friend, the great Napoleon, to the world's bleak end. While on his slaughtered troops your tribes are fed, you cleanse his camp and carry off his dead. As speculated by Buell, quote, Barlow may have sensed, as he was completing his poem, that he would soon join the carrion on which ravens fed. On December 19th, Joel Barlow began to suffer from respiratory issues, but they pressed forward with their journey west. By the time they reached the town of Zanovets the next day, however, his condition was so bad that it was clear he could go no further. Barlow was diagnosed with pneumonia, and by the 25th, he was in a coma. The next day, December 26th, 1812, U.S. Minister to France Joel Barlow passed away at the age of 58. Barlow's nephew wanted to transport his body to Königsberg to arrange for it to be brought back to the U.S. on a ship, but he was finally persuaded to inter his uncle in the parish churchyard at Zanovets. Barlow's remains are still there as of 2023. Hill summarized Barlow's time as U.S. Minister to France as follows, quote, the personal charm that lent force to his powers to persuade clearly counted for less, however, during his mission to France. Napoleon's top advisors, though they appreciated his engaging personality, gave him little reason to believe he could persuade them to sign a commercial treaty or even accord better treatment to American ships and cargoes. On the big issues, Barlow was often his worst enemy. As an exemplar of goodwill, he had few equals, but as an advocate of various causes, he too often revealed a self-defeating tendency to overreach, to ask too much, and thereby weaken the fabric of his argument. In terms of the impact of Barlow's untimely demise on the Madison administration, at a crucial time in European affairs, there was now, at this point, no U.S. minister at the two key European capitals from an American foreign policy standpoint, London and Paris. There was, however, still a seasoned diplomat in the city of St. Petersburg, our old friend John Quincy Adams. Adams had watched the drama of the Grande Armée's invasion of Russia play out from St. Petersburg. As early as August 16th, the U.S. minister to Russia wrote to his father, former President Adams, that, quote, the Fabian system of warfare, which succeeded in our Revolutionary War and which has recently been successful against the generals of Napoleon in Portugal, is now systematically tried against himself. It probably was never brought to a severer test, but the modern Alexander may, after all, be destined, like his predecessor, to be arrested in his career of domination by the Scythians. As described in episode 4.9, U.S. Minister Adams had grown close to Tsar Alexander and held him in high esteem. He would go on to describe the Tsar as, quote, the Titus of the age, the delight of humankind. It didn't take long for Adams to take from the events that he was witnessing firsthand the following conclusion written in a letter in late November 1812. Quote, the great events daily occurring in the country whence I now write you are strong and continual additional warnings to us not to involve ourselves in the inexorable labyrinth of European politics and revolutions. Adams could only watch with trepidation from afar as news of his own nation's war with Britain came. In his discussions with Russian Foreign Minister Count Nikolai Petrovich Rumyantsev, Adams took great liberties to share with Rumyantsev that, quote, I lament the war, and I should rejoice to see friendship and harmony taking place between America and England rather than discord and hostility. as Tsar Alexander was concerned that a war with the U.S. would divert Britain's attentions from the French, and thus enable Napoleon to divert more resources against Russia, and was eager to continue to cultivate his nation's budding relationship with the United States. Rumyantsev was authorized in September 1812 to offer for the Tsar to mediate between the Americans and the British to come to a peaceful resolution to end their conflict. Adams promptly sent the offer back to his government in Washington, but it would take some time for an answer to arrive. Thus, we'll leave Mr. Adams here for now, but don't worry, dear listener, it won't be nearly as long before we catch back up with him again, as, spoiler alert, he's about to be quite busy. In the meantime, we need to return back to France to address one more matter, because while Napoleon was off marching through and then retreating from Russia, there were plans being put into motion back home to bring an end to his rule. General Claude François Desmalets was described as, quote, one of those men produced by revolutions, but who, lacking the qualities necessary to succeed, finds himself stymied and then succeeded by those more talented than he. His rise in the French Revolutionary armies had been halted by Napoleon's ascension to the title of emperor, a move which Malais had objected. And then, after a dispute with the French military governor of Rome, Malais found himself dismissed and whiling away his days in Paris. He soon found that he was not alone in this bitter state of limbo, as he soon began to associate with, quote, other prematurely retired and equally disgruntled army officers who made no secret of their own loathing of Bonaparte. It wouldn't be long before they began to plot their common enemy's downfall. As early as 1807, the French state police learned of the plotting of Malais and his friends, and at one point in 1808, an order was issued for Malais' arrest. He was promptly rounded up and incarcerated at the La Force prison. Even from prison, Malais continued to plot, and it wasn't long before word of his new plot got back to the police and was quickly quashed. A few years passed, and finally, the head of the state police decided that Malais no longer posed an immediate threat and ordered him transferred to, quote, a small mental institution. The fire of rebellion, however, still lived strong in Malais' heart, and soon he was pulling together new conspirators and a new plan. In the dark of night on October 22, 1812, the plan went into effect as Malais and a conspirator made a break for it. From the very beginning, Malais' plans had revolved around the idea of forging government documents to attest to Napoleon's death on the battlefield, quote, and the equally fictitious resolution by the Senate to create a new government, ousting and arresting members of Napoleon's cabinet and high command. In this instance, their target was the Popincourt barracks, immediately behind the institution that Malais had been held in. Malais posed as a fictional General Lamotte and took charge of the 10th National Guard Regiment the morning of the 23rd, which he then used to free some of his fellow conspirator ex-generals, who he then empowered with armed forces to go and start arresting government officials. Malais himself went to arrest the military governor of Paris, but that's where things started to go wrong. The military governor demanded to read the orders that Malais held himself, and, quote, Malais whipped out a pistol and shot the general in the face in front of his wife. Malais then went to the headquarters of the military governor's second in command with forged orders that Malais was the military governor's replacement. The second in command immediately realized that something was wrong and was able to consult with another general who recognized Malais, as he himself had escorted Malais from La Force to the institution a few months prior. The two confronted Malais, and the conspirator was soon in custody. As noted by Napoleon biographer Alan Sholm, quote, of 84 persons arrested in the subsequent investigation and officially accused, 14 were found guilty of treason and sentenced to death for attempting to overthrow Napoleon. And although most of the senior officers involved had no knowledge that the written orders handed them by Malais were forgeries and had thus acted in good faith, nonetheless, they were executed by firing squad immediately after the trial, for there was no process of appeal. Though the Malais plot was put down within a few hours, it would have long-term ramifications. For, once things were secure once more, some senior members of Napoleon's government began to reflect. If, as described by Scholem, quote, one isolated madman had nearly succeeded in overthrowing Napoleon, and yes, even the police minister ultimately concluded that, quote, General Millet could indeed have been in complete control of much of the government in very little time. What did that say about the state of the empire? It was becoming increasingly apparent that the Peninsular War was a lost cause, and now the emperor and the remnants of the Grande Armée were limping back to France. The empire's finances were on shaky grounds, and shares of the Banque de France would soon begin a steep plunge. When senior leaders start to doubt the system in which they are leading, as we have seen at numerous points in history, their thoughts naturally start to turn to self-preservation. And if Napoleon could not or would not ensure security, it's not like France hasn't had a change of government once or twice within the living history of many. The storming of the Bastille had only been 23 years prior, after all. As you can imagine, we will return to the situation in Europe in future episodes, as that would have major implications on the course of the War of 1812 and the possibilities for a peaceful resolution of it. In our next episode, we'll return to the Western Hemisphere for an episode I'd like to call Hello, Goodbye. Until then, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank Alex again for providing the opening quote for this episode. I'd also like to thank Christian of Your Podcast Pal for his audio editing services on this episode. Enlisting his services allows me to focus more on the other aspects of podcasting while at the same time ensuring that you're provided with a quality auditory experience. If you'd like to work with Christian on providing his editing expertise for your podcast, check out his website at yourpodcastpal.com. Special thanks also to the folks at the Colonial Music Institute at George Washington's Mount Vernon, who graciously allowed us the use of clips from Hull's Victory as performed by David and Ginger Hildebrand for our intro and outro music. You can find out more about the great work that the Colonial Music Institute is doing to research and share information about early American music and dance by going to mountvernon.org and typing in Colonial Music Institute in the search field. Links to the websites for all these folks, as well as sources used for this information, past episodes of the podcast, links to more information about all of the U.S. presidents, and much more can be found at the website, which is presidenciespodcast.com. There, you can also find information about how you can help support the podcast, including, but not limited to, becoming a patron of the podcast. Our patrons help to offset the cost of producing the podcast, so I cannot thank them enough. Just go to patreon.com/presidencies and sign up. If you'd like to reach out to me, please feel free to send me an email at presidenciespodcast@gmail.com. I'm also available on social media. I'm on Mastodon, Post, and Facebook as Presidencies, on Twitter at Presidencies89, and on Instagram and Threads at Presidencies Podcast, all one word. Last, but certainly not least, I'd like to thank you for listening. Until next time, stay safe and healthy, be kind to one another, and take care, dear friends.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, And I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.